This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Studying the origins of life can have some benefits. Scientists have been able to search for clues to the beginnings of life down to the cellular level. And then they've narrowed that search down even further.
We work with molecules. We engineer the molecules of life because it's biomolecular.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series continues with a look at the study of our DNA with this molecular biochemistry and how this study has resulted in some new and unexpected advances in medicine. We'll also spend an academic minute studying another type of DNA, the building blocks of flowers. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. We are not far away from being able to order up our own DNA profile to find out what diseases we should be on the lookout for. That's exactly the type of research that Dr. David Deamer is involved with. Dr. Deamer is a professor emeritus of chemistry at UC Davis and research professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He spoke to the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about his work as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. They started by talking about biomolecular engineering.
Well, it is a new kind of engineering. It's the only one in the country, perhaps in the world, that is an actual department name. And what that means is that we work with molecules. We engineer the molecules of life because it's biomolecular. So we work on the nanoscale, that is nanometers. These are the size of molecules. And we work very often with biological materials such as nucleic acids, in my case, proteins, protein structure, and so on. So that's a new way to do engineering.
Many of us who are listening to you in the capital region of New York, and of course, you've come to the region to speak at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, are aware of something called nanoscale because we have the Nano School of Science and Engineering next to the University at Albany. So this area is already embarking on some of this research.
Yeah, nanoscale has just come up in profile over the last maybe 10 or so years. The reason is that we can now manipulate single atoms, for heaven's sakes, using little bits of electrons, light beams, atomic force microscopes, and things like that. So when you get down to that nanoscale, you're talking about anything from single atoms all the way up to single molecules. And these all are in that nanometer time or nanometer size range.
So we keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller in our
right.
abilities to manipulate these yeah. molecules. And what's amazing here, Dr. Deamer, is that, of course, this segment on The Best of Our Knowledge deals with origins of life. And one of the things that you're doing is looking at, and I'll say it and you'll explain it, combinatorial chemistry in the prebiotic environment. Prebiotic certainly speaks to that soup in the origins of life.
Yeah. I kind of like this idea of combinatorial chemistry because this is in the drug industry. There are robots that do combinatorial experiments for the drug researchers. And what that means is that there's a robot that will have perhaps 1,000 tiny containers, and it'll move a probe through those containers, changing the concentration one by one over very small scales of change. And then this experiment, the one that works best, shows up in this matrix of experiments. It's the one that works best, you see, the drug that works best, for example. So that's combinatorial chemistry. You combine things over many, many small experiments, and I think that that's the best way to think about the origin of life.
Now, I assume these robots are programmed by humans, but
oh, yeah.
are they randomly selecting amounts? Are they programmed to do exactly the amounts of mixing? You know, do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, let's say that you have a new drug. You want to test it to see its effect on living cells. You don't know what the pH is, that's the acidity or alkalinity, what it works best. You don't know what the temperature works best. You don't know what the ions around it, the ionic concentrations work best. So you vary those all the way from low pH to high pH, from low to high concentration, and so forth. So those variables always have a sweet spot. And that sweet spot is what you're looking for. Which combination works best out of all those thousands that you've tried.
And when you say works best, you mean for whatever this drug is going to treat?
That's right. Which combination is most effective in slowing the growth of cancer cells, just for example?
So here's this combinatorial chemistry in the prebiotic environment theme. Tell us about this. What's the prebiotic part of this? What's the origins of life part that your research involves?
The idea is that to do combinatorial chemistry, you have to have lots of individual containers, thousands in a typical one of these pharmaceutical robots. So how do you get containers on the early Earth? Because all we have is rock, ocean, atmosphere, pretty hot back then, you know, much warmer than today. So how can you sort of mix things up and do it in containers? And what we've discovered is microscopic containers. And these are made out of what we call lipids. A lipid is the same molecule that surrounds every cell of your body and mine. It surrounds the cell of every bacterial species, the simplest forms of life. So it's a membrane that forms a boundary between the inside and the outside. And as soon as you let me have a small volume like that, measured in microns, a few microns, suddenly combinatorial chemistry becomes possible.
And is this done in a laboratory, or are these lipids put out in the environment?
It's done in the laboratory, but I have tested them in the environment.
Oh, and?
And, well, we've been to Kamchatka, for example, twice.
Tell people where that is, just in case they don't know.
Kamchatka. It's a magnificent part of Russia.
Yes.
We fly up to Anchorage, Alaska, hop on a plane next day, and 4 hours later, we end up in Petropavlovsk. About another 6 hours of driving through this almost wilderness, we end up on a volcano called Mount Mutnovsky. We walk down, we climb up, we walk down into the crater, and there we can do experiments in what we call a prebiotic analog site. It's an area of the present Earth that we think is like the prebiotic Earth was.
Because of how warm, I imagine, the substances mixing, the lava, the pumice, all that stuff that's in there, right?
All of that stuff. So it's got liquid water, you know, that's very essential for life. It's got the heat to keep things, you know, moving around, diffusing. It's got chemical and physical energy, and that's really very important. If you're going to start life up, you must have an energy source, and that volcanoes offer that.
So how do you place them there and then get them back to test them?
Well, we bring a powder, and the powder contains a mixture of amino acids, nucleotides, well, actually nucleobases, it's called. These are the A, G, C, and T of DNA, for example. We actually use A, G, C, and U, which is RNA. It's got some lipid in it, a fatty acid. It's got phosphate. It's got glycerol. So this is a prebiotic soup. And we poured this into a small container, not a true container, of course. This is a hot puddle boiling in the middle in one of these little volcanic areas in Kamchatka. And we then measured what happened to those molecules, to all that stuff that we put into this prebiotic analog site.
And what happened?
What happened is that containers were produced. The lipid that we added produced a froth around the edge of the pool. The froth was tiny bubbles. This is the containers that we needed. So we know that what happened in the laboratory, the production of containers, also can happen on this analog site to the prebiotic Earth. So that increased our confidence in the story that we're telling.
Well, the stories that the scientists keep telling to me lead me to keep on asking them once again, and I will ask you, Dr. Diemer, does life ultimately will out no matter what environment it is in?
No. There are limits. We have extremophiles. These are bacteria that survive at very low pH, battery acid pH. We have
acid lakes, for example.
Acid lakes, just for example. We have thermophiles that can live in near boiling water. We have a whole bunch of other philes. You know, you just name a phile and you've got something that lives there. But what we cannot find alive is life that lives without water. So there's no such thing as a dryophile, you know.
Interesting.
Life can survive without water as bacterial spores do, but it cannot go through a life cycle unless there's liquid water. So that's just one limit of life. It's got to have liquid water.
So that is a very important piece to understand, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's why Curiosity is looking for evidence of liquid water on Mars, or at least in the past on Mars.
Then you have other things that might play into this. What about oxygen?
Oxygen is a recent phenomenon on the Earth. Oxygen is a result of photosynthesis, and about approximately 2 billion years ago, we began to have an oxygen atmosphere by the action of a lot of oxygenic bacteria, they're called. They actually make oxygen as a byproduct. So we exist. We human beings and all life on Earth now that use oxygen exist because these bacteria and now plants first began to make oxygen. Before that, there was very little, if any, oxygen in the atmosphere, and life had to find a way to do its thing without oxygen.
So again, life on some level found its way.
It found its way. It made something that changed life on Earth. When oxygen began, nervous systems became possible. Before that time, we could not have had multicellular organisms.
Still to come, David Gustina's conversation with Dr. David Deamer continues with a look at possible different forms of life on this or other planets. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1230. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. David Deamer, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at UC Davis and Research Professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about his work as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
Is it possible, just possible, Dr. Deamer, that there might be a form of life we don't recognize as life? And that might be discovered someday, whether it's even on this planet or somewhere in the universe.
Yeah, Paul Davies at Arizona has suggested that there might be a parallel life that we don't recognize, and that we ought to look for it on the Earth, that life may have begun more than once, and there's some form of life that is still there.
Undiscovered.
But we're undiscovered, right, as viruses were. When you realize that viruses, we only knew about those for rather recently. They're not truly alive, but it's a form of life that was a total surprise when we first began to realize what it was all about.
And we hear more and more now about microbes and bacteria and good and bad bacteria and the combinations of those microbes in the human body and on the Earth. And I'm sure as we keep going into this nanoscale world, we're going to be learning more and more, which has an effect on, for example, antibiotics and how much you use those things.
Yeah, antibiotics is a very interesting subject because would you imagine that oxygen might have been the first antibiotic?
Really?
Bacteria make antibiotics to clear the field away of competing organisms. So that's what antibiotics really are all about. Bacteria against bacteria, fungi against bacteria. The first bacteria that learned to make oxygen took over because the other bacteria were poisoned by the oxygen, just as though it were an antibiotic.
And so are we saying that, like the antibiotics now, the danger is that it creates quote-unquote superbugs or superbacteria?
Yeah, that's just a clear indication of evolution happening right now. Bacteria are selected for antibiotic resistance, and they can grow at the expense of their host or other bacteria.
Is there another way, then, that medical science, I guess, should look at this? Are we moving to an area where understanding those microbes and their combination uniquely in our bodies might be a better way to treat and fight those diseases than the antibiotics themselves?
My understanding, I'm not in pharmacology myself,
sure,
but my understanding is that we are just about at the edge of our ability to use antibiotics with certain kinds of microorganisms that have developed resistance. We're down to the last few antibiotics that actually work. So if that keeps going, we are going to be in trouble because we will have microbial infections that we are unable to fight off in the usual medical way. We're going to go back to our immune system and hope that we can make it through.
I see here, Dr. Deamer, that your primary research area concerns the manner in which, I love this, linear macromolecules traverse nanoscopic channels. How about English?
DNA sequencing is very important now. We now know the human genome, over 3 billion base pairs in every cell of our body. It's pretty amazing that we have managed to get to that point.
And how quickly we've gotten
to that. And how quickly, just a matter of 10, 20 years, and here we are. Still, it's expensive. If I wanted my genome on a thumb drive, which I'm going to get someday, and you will too, very likely, if I wanted my genome on a thumb drive, it'd be around $10,000 out of pocket. Oof. So that's pretty expensive. On the other hand, if it got down to $1,000 or even a few hundred, I'd go for it. I'd want my genome on a thumb drive just to see what it was that makes me me, as it were.
And it could have some valuable information, right?
Absolutely. This is a predictor of health and future disease. If you are a teenager, your genes will tell how sensitive you might be to, for example, diabetes, getting diabetes later in life. How sensitive you are to testosterone that produces male pattern baldness. That's in our genes. How sensitive you are to aspirin. My brother, the physician, has an aspirin sensitivity. Other people are sensitive to penicillin. All of these things, of course, are written in our genetic information. So it's very important to have this information. What we've done is to go to single molecule sequencing. All of the sequencing that is done now works with literally millions, trillions of molecules, and it's amazing what can be done. It really does work. We can do it with about one error in 10,000 bases. It's very accurate.
Wow.
We're trying to do that with single molecules because it's much less expensive. It is the original DNA. It's the DNA as opposed to being copies of DNA as you use for other techniques. And the way to do it is to take a DNA molecule and pull it through a nanoscopic pore the size of the molecule. I'm showing you here with my finger and my hand. So just imagine I made my fingers into a little hole there. That's the pore that we're working with. About 1.6 nanometers in diameter. So here we put a voltage across it. So it's positive on one side, negative on this side. The DNA is swimming around. It feels the voltage and it gets pulled through. As it's pulled through, we can get information about each base going through the pore.
Is it chemical information? What is it that what's the information that you're gathering?
It's electrical information. Uh-huh. Each base gives a different electrical signal because the pore is passing what we call an ionic current due to the voltage. And that current changes with respect to each base going through.
What does it mean?
Well, that's what we have to decipher. What it really means in practical terms is that sequences are going to be cheap. The company that is developing this nanopore sequencing is releasing its first devices for early users to test. The sequencer is handheld. It's the size of a cell phone, even a little bit smaller. You plug it into a laptop computer. You put a bit of DNA into a tiny well and come back a few hours later, and there is several billion bases all analyzed for you.
And what will the analysis look like? Will you have to go further to get a more specific understanding of what the information means?
You would have to compare your DNA to all the other DNAs that we know about and see which changes, which differences in your DNA might indicate future health or future disease processes. So it's always a comparison with the rest of the human genome.
So do you foresee a day when those handheld cell phones or wristwatches or whatever they're going to be in the future have an app or whatever it's going to be called that you enter this, drop this into, and immediately analyzes the millions of other bits of data out there and comes back with some sort of prognosis?
I think that I get your question. And if I have to look ahead in my own life, I'll bet that just a few years from now, I will have my genome on a thumb drive. It's not very much information, 3 billion bases. I can go to my physician. They'll plug that into their laptop, which will go off to some central facility. And my DNA will be compared against the human genome with all of the sorts of little differences between my DNA and everybody else's. And they will be able to tell me whether the fact that my father had diabetes late in life, what is the probability that I have to watch for diabetes in my own life? And in fact, you know, this is a real concern that
I have. Talk about preventative medicine.
That's right. This is preventative medicine at its best, individualized, personalized medicine.
There's this other aspect of this whole thing that you're talking about as my mind is being blown because of what you're saying here, Dr. Deamer. But with every advance in technology and our ability to get more complex in our understandings of things, do we also risk being too sure of ourselves?
Yeah, knowledge is always a two-edged sword, as they say, an old adage. Knowledge of nuclear physics leads to nuclear reactors, but also to nuclear weapons, you know. This knowledge that we're now getting about the human genome, it's hard for me to imagine how it could be misused except in some legalistic term. And the law is already accommodating the fact that if you're an insurance company, you'd like to know about somebody's genome. Because then the bet that you are making with this person, that's what insurance really is, it's a bet. You can hedge the bet because you know that such and such a genome is more likely to have this or that disease.
So the irony is that while you may know you're going to get diabetes, you won't get any treatment for it.
Yeah, at least not afford it anyway, get affordable insurance. Well. So the laws are now being put in place to prevent this sort of invasion of privacy.
Dr. David Deamer is a professor emeritus of chemistry at UC Davis and research professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He spoke to the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about his work as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. To learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series, go to origins.rpi.edu. Well, as long as we're talking about DNA, let's talk about some different DNA, the DNA of flowers. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Flowers can be seen as a beautiful display on the diversity of nature. And as Victor Albert of the University of Buffalo's Department of Biological Science posits, we can learn a great deal by examining the ancestral lineage of some ancient species.
The famous naturalist Charles Darwin called the proliferation of flowers on Earth an abominable mystery. If you look at the fossil record, there was little evidence of flowering plants until the mid-Cretaceous period, about 100 million years ago. Then, for unknown reasons, the number of species suddenly exploded. Major food crops like rice, coffee, and avocados all owe their existence to this ancient upheaval. To find out what might have caused it, my colleagues and I studied a plant called Amberella, which grows on the Pacific island of New Caledonia. It's a small tree with cream-colored blossoms that look like little clusters of fireworks. Amberella is special because it comes from an ancient lineage. Its evolutionary path diverged from that of all other flowers very early on. When we sequenced Amberella's genome, we found evidence that the common ancestor of all flowering plants, including Amberella, underwent what scientists call a polyploidy event. This is where every bit of an organism's DNA gets duplicated, and it happened about 200 million years ago in this case. If you have two copies of the same gene, one can develop new functions without disrupting existing ones. Of course, not all duplicated genes are kept over time, but those with new and adaptive functions are thought to contribute to radiations of biodiversity, like the abrupt expansion in flower variety that stumped Darwin. DNA doubling may sound strange, but it can happen in animals too. The ancestors of all vertebrates, including humans, underwent two duplications. Ray-finned fish experienced yet another, which may explain why there are so many types of ray-finned fish today. As we continue to study Amberella and compare it to other plants, we expect to learn more about the evolution of flowers and how genome doubling may have encouraged their progress and growth.
That was Victor Albert of the University of Buffalo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.